Welcome to Let's Talk America here on Bright TV on Television, produced and brought to you by the folks at IMTV. And I'm glad to be with you today, especially because we're, I think, in the midst of a situation that is increasingly clearly marked as perhaps the most dangerous situation we have faced since the end of World War II. In which the implications are such that we have to be thinking carefully about whether or not the world is now in a situation where one of the major powers in the world could be excused for being tempted by the belief that if they initiate a conflict over which we have drawn a clear line in the sand, the end result will be either war, which we're probably not prepared for right this minute, one could talk about that. So they're going to be war, or it's going to be the defeat of the enemy, us. Either one seems to me to be unacceptable from the point of view of the people of the United States. In this beginning, I have the pleasure, and also I think in this context, the privilege of talking to Gordon Chang, one of the most thoughtful and knowledgeable people when it comes to China, its policies, its present leadership, and so forth and so on. And I have been looking forward to this in order to get a sense of how this remarkable man looks at what is going on in China in terms of what it implies for the challenge that is now facing the United States. Gordon, I'm tempted to start out by saying that something in my mind lately has been more and more thinking of it as an existential threat. One of those things that if we don't handle it correctly, will along perhaps with the attack on the Twin Towers, historians would look back on it, if they were still writing about us at all, they would look back on it and say, that was it. This is the era in which the United States, beginning of the end or the end. Of what was a remarkable, I think, run, especially for a government of, by, and for the people that most philosophers in human history would have said wouldn't work anyway. But we did work it out remarkably well. As you look at this situation overall, am I kind of being excessively apprehensive as I look at it? Because I think the opportunities for us to miscalculate and for the Chinese possibly to miscalculate as a result are enormous. And final point, I also think we're facing it at a time when I at least would say we can't really trust the president of the United States, the present one, to be operating in our interest. I mean, from what I have been able to read over the last several years, we have to entertain the possibility that we're dealing with an administration that one is so left-leaning that it's hardly to be distinguished from the Chinese Communist Party, and two, right now offers up somebody at the helm, the Democrat Party does, that is also directly compromised by the possibility that they may be an agent of that foreign power. On last time I looked, if you make money hand over fist from one of America's enemies, I'm not going to trust you. Am I wrong? I mean, this looks like a situation that common sense says we ought to be taking with the utmost seriousness, not necessarily at this or that administration, but as the American people. I think we're seriously in threat.
I couldn't agree with you more, Alan, and thank you for the privilege of talking to you, which is also a pleasure, of course. There's a lot to unpack there, but we'll start with the existential threat. And China does pose one of those to the United States for a number of reasons. First of all, because an insecure regime in Beijing is worried about the inspirational impact of our values and our form of governance on the Chinese people. So the Communist Party believes that it can never be secure until the United States is destroyed. And it has worked to do that in a number of different ways. COVID-19, fentanyl, intellectual property theft, attempts to subvert our republic, all the rest of it. Now, with regard to the President of the United States, we all know about Hunter Biden and about his relationships with China, which don't happen in the absence of influence peddling and corruption. But it's not just a question of whether the Biden family received billions of dollars. the issue is always going to be what the Chinese think. And in this regard, we should go back to the date that I'll remember for quite some time, November 28th, 2020. That's the date that Di Dongsheng, a prominent academic in Beijing, gave a lecture in Shanghai to a live audience, and it was live streamed across China. And this was a big event in the Chinese Republic. One of the themes of it, and actually the dominant theme, was that no American could resist China. Every American could be bought by China. And in that regard, Dee got a laugh from the live audience when he mentioned two words, Hunter Biden. So the Chinese think that they own the president of the United States, because going through Dee's lecture, it was clear that they believed that they would control outcomes at the highest levels of the American political system. And that's what's going to drive them to engage in exceedingly dangerous behavior. So yes, this is a moment of great peril for the United States.
One of the most recent events, this deal that was just brokered by the Chinese, which I think in ordinary sense should be kind of an unexpected event, but it has taken place. A deal brokered by the Communist Chinese that has Saudi Arabia, one of the major partners of the United States in the Middle East, and therefore I think in the world, in any case, and the Iranians, and the Chinese have brought them together. It strikes me that even if others want to neglect the possibility of an existential threat, as I pondered that move by Saudi Arabia, I'm thinking to myself, well, maybe they are taking account of it. Am I wrong?
You know, you're absolutely right about that. China is now the dominant outside power in the Middle East because it got those two enemies to actually come to agreement. And the thing about this is that the Saudis know that this agreement is not good for their interests. But the reason why they signed it was because they can't trust the United States, the Biden administration, and they felt they had no choice. That is, from any number of different perspectives, that shows you that this is a debacle for American interests. To put that into context, President Trump had the most successful Middle East policy of any American president since FDR. And we have transitioned from the best policy since FDR to the worst ever under Biden. And there's been one problem after another in the Middle East, and they're clearly related to what Biden has done. He has undone the Abraham Accords of President Trump and all the other good work that occurred in those 4 years.
And I think it's kind of, to me, telling that our discussion is taking place in a context. And I don't want to get into the Ukraine per se, I don't think, but it strikes me that right now we're in a situation where we have, rightly or wrongly, given into the temptation to concentrate our attention in terms of lots of expenditures, the wholesale involvement of our NATO allies and so forth and so on, in something that involves a conflict between Russia and one of its erstwhile components of the USSR, but in a way that then has us committing resources, including our military resources, while kind of China sits back, goes into the back room with Russia to discuss God knows what. But in any case, the product is something that engages America in a way that absorbs our attention and our resources, and that of our major allies in the world. And I look back at that and I say, well, and I remember you, Gordon, because I have it in my mind that we should expect the Chinese to give in, Chinese leaders give in to his ambition to take over Taiwan in the course of the next several years. We shouldn't expect it to be out there somewhere. And is he likely to face a situation more conducive to possible success than that he has a friendly relationship with a power that is now draining resources and attention from the United States under an administration that doesn't appear all that competent to deal with the situation they're already dealing with? much less one that then involves a major exertion of our military power in order to either deter or respond to an attack on Taiwan. Where does this leave us?
Yeah, Ukraine and Taiwan are interconnected because Xi Jinping is looking at the Biden administration's response. I mean, first of all, the most important thing is that Putin attacked last February of last year, after the debacle from which was the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And there was, I think, in Putin's mind, a feeling that the United States was no longer capable. And so you have one tragedy leading to another. So you've got Afghanistan to Ukraine, now Ukraine to the Middle East perhaps to Taiwan, or it could be China attacking Japan or China attacking Philippines or China attacking India. We don't know which one, but clearly these are related one to the other. And also we're seeing a Russia-China axis. And around it, you have the proxies of Iran, North Korea, Algeria. So this is the world dividing into two. This is the world falling apart. And we can see that there is going to be war ahead. And unless something changes, we will be involved in a war with China.
Well, see, I guess my question would then be, are we going to be involved in that war in a situation where, to put it mildly, we have the possibility of a compromised chief executive who has not shown the characteristics of a capable chief executive for wartime leadership? Just the opposite. Has anything Biden touched not gone awry? And in terms of his military leadership, the fact that after making a decision, you can't even withdraw a superb, we still had a superb military force, and they couldn't do it in a fashion orderly enough to avoid both casualties and the disastrous impression that we have now become a country incompetent, even in the basics of warfare?
Yeah, we don't have a wartime president. I mean, it was very clear that in Afghanistan, if you were going to withdraw, and that's another question, but if you were going to withdraw, it's very clear. I mean, the civilians come out, our friends come out, and then the military comes out. Biden flipped the order. And he also left, you know, $85 billion or so worth of equipment. Now, the military probably told him, look, it would be more expensive to take it out than leave it. But as the commander-in-chief, he should have realized that leaving that equipment in Afghanistan would have consequences of the Taliban using it, of the Chinese getting a look at our equipment, plus also just the public relations debacle. The president should have understood that, and obviously he didn't. So we had the worst of all possible worlds, and we're still feeling the reverberations of that. Got to remember, you go to 2013, when President Obama talked about the red line in Syria and then didn't enforce it. Well, it took about 5 or 6 years to repair the damage from that failure. The Afghanistan failure is so much worse than the Syrian red line. And we're going to be paying this for quite some time. And that failure in Afghanistan could very well lead to the next global war. As a matter of fact, it looks almost probable that it will. As I said, it will unless something changes. And I don't see anything changing in the near to the distant future.
Well, see, I guess I would also have a certain sense of urgency about the moment we're in and the coming years, because if you're going to go to war with somebody, you're always going to try to make a calculation of how hard it's going to be and what kind of could give you an indication of whether you're going to face a formidable foe. I think the whole outcome of that balloon episode, where they were clearly trying to take stock, and et cetera, sends a message. And I don't think it's the message. And here's what really gives me pause. And people might say, you're being alarmist, raising this idea, and so forth and so on. No, but the Chinese have been working like the devil, not only to develop a competent more than competent, an impressive military capability and project their power wherever they want. But I don't know. I think they've also been working in order to develop a nuclear arsenal that they, I think, would be more likely to use than ever the Russians were, if you don't mind my saying so. And because of the both what I have gleaned as just a little, you know, researches of my own, of the kind of mindset that results almost from the history of China itself, but also of what we've seen in the present leadership there. And they seem also, and you've reported on this, to be preparing for that eventuality of war in a way that doesn't suggest they're waiting to be attacked, but that they're planning to satisfy their ambitions in some way. Could be Taiwan, but I think that may be the safest one, because at the end of the day, what if they draw a conclusion that says that in the most important point about certain aspects of contemporary warfare, the president of the United States isn't a guy who's going to push the button?
Yeah, this is, I think, the most dangerous moment in history. And the reason why I think that is you have Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, and Kim Jong-un making threats to preemptively use their nuclear weapons. Now, a lot of people will say that 1962 is the most dangerous moment in history, Cuban Missile Crisis. I could argue 1961 was even more perilous. That was the Checkpoint Charlie crisis in Berlin, where we actually had American and Soviet armor very close to each other pointing their weapons. But we know from the archives, Alan, that neither Khrushchev nor Kennedy in 1961 or 1962 was willing to use their nuclear weapons. We don't know that about Vladimir Putin, Xi Jinping, or Kim Jong-un today. So that's what makes this extremely perilous. And we Americans are not thinking about nuclear deterrence. Biden does not want to build the weapons that we need to deter Russia, China, North Korea, Iran. And that makes this, I think, especially dangerous for the United States.
See, and I think that some people might say we're talking about, well, would the Chinese, you know, be making a miscalculation and get into this and so forth and so on. My problem is that going through it as honestly as I can, based on the little information I can glean here and there, I can't say that I think it would be a miscalculation. I think it would be a studied, deliberate calculation that they have reached an historic moment in the history of the world and in China's history, when the kind of, I don't know, decisiveness that was from time to time exhibited in the course of the dynastic history of China, and the leader of China right now is somebody who takes account of those things, it seems to me. He sees himself in that context and sees China now coming into its own after several centuries, perhaps, of humiliation. And he's going to be the guy who does it. Is this just musing? Because I don't feel like it is. I think we have reached a moment when a world-class actor with nuclear weapons is in a position where they would deliberately launch something which they know from their own point of view they can recover from so long as they win.
Xi Jinping he's got the most dangerous combination of attributes I can think of. He's extremely aggressive, very ambitious. And as you say, he believes that this is China's moment. At the same time, he's got problems inside China that he has no answers for. And so you put all those things together and it suggests that the threshold for the use of force on the part of Xi Jinping is very low. And we know that that Xi has been taking a page out of Vladimir Putin's playbook, basically threatening the use of nuclear weapons to make sure the United States does not come to the aid of Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, or whatever. So that's how this could really get out of hand. And we know the way the Chinese think about war. We know the utter disrespect they have for the United States right now, which was exhibited during that balloon travel across the United States. Also, we saw that a few days ago when China appointed its new defense minister, who has since 2018 been under sanctions by the United States, which means that essentially the Chinese think that we will lift our sanctions in order to talk to China's defense minister. That shows an arrogance which is unparalleled, something that we haven't seen since the Mao era.
Well, given what we're talking about, from what direction would come something that would actually deal with it? I mean, I think Given the nature of things, you would have to look in America usually at, well, maybe the other party is going to start thinking seriously about this and try to both signalize and push, move, otherwise get the country into a position where we can handle the situation. We got 2 minutes left or so. What is to be done? And do you think that there are actors now in our political arena, and particularly in terms of this present party structure that has one anti-American party and one party kind of half-heartedly grounded on a grassroots that's absolutely dedicated to America? But will that result in the kind of both spine and intelligent, deliberate response that would seem to be necessary here?
We don't have that in the political spectrum right now. And it's not just Biden, it's also conservative Republicans don't understand the urgency of the situation. And I think that what we need to do is we need to start putting our military on a higher state of alert. We need to make sure that we disentangle our economies, that we get the Chinese off our farm and ranch land, that we get Chinese agents out of our country. And we do all of this with that sense of urgency, which I believe is absolutely required at this moment.
Mm. Well, see, I thoroughly agree with that. But where, I mean, we're coming up on a presidential election. People are going to be competing in leadership and this and that way. We're not necessarily mentioning this or that name, but do you feel confident that we are now presented with a stable of leadership that's going to see the nature of the crisis that we're in and offer us an individual capable of leadership during that crisis?
Three words. I'm afraid not.
I knew somehow you were going to say that because partly because we think a lot alike. And I think that it's a very disturbing thing. It's the kind of thing that I know it sounds silly, but it has me laying awake at night because I guess I care deeply about this country. And I think we've reached a moment when people who care need to start asking, not questions of personality and this and that, but questions of hard fact about how we achieve a leadership that is going to be able to handle what I think is the most serious challenge possibly we've ever faced. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it very much. And as I was hoping we would, we've had a really serious conversation. Y'all ponder it. I'll be right back after this.
Hey everybody, I'm Brightsy on TV. I'm Cash Patel, and you can get my new book, Government Gangsters, at governmentgangsters.com, and check out what we're doing at fightwithcash.com. As we were talking about all the time, it starts and happens at the local level, so please join up and sign the fight. And to everyone watching Brightsy on TV, I love your uncensored truth format. Please watch it, please help it grow, and we'll see you down the trail.
Riots, recession, food prices, gas prices, violation of our liberties. These issues are keeping Americans awake at night. Sleepless nights aren't good for your health. Millions are suffering from sleep gap disorder. I'm Dr. Steve Hodson, and I have a natural solution to overcome this dreaded sleep gap disorder, my proprietary sleep formula. One capsule of sleep formula will help you achieve a great night's sleep for as little as 75 cents per night. Visit our website, physicianspreferencevitamins.com, and enter the promo code SLEEPNOW. It's hard to stand up against tyranny when you're tired. Pray for our country and get a good night's sleep.
Mike Adams here with an operator, a deployment leader on the Texas southern border who's been using these satellite-based bivy sticks for very effective communications. And he's here just give us a few words about how these bivy sticks are operating, how it's helping he and his team members. And remember, these are available through the satellite phone store, sat123.com. It's satellite-based text messaging, works when no cell towers work or aren't reachable.
We use these to communicate GPS cords to when we are seeing drug runners or people carrying stuff. We've had, you know, bust up to 13,600 pounds worth of marijuana and fentanyl that we have been on operations with in conjunction with federal agents and supporting them in their operations.
So they are pro-America and pro-humanitarian in helping to keep our country and our community safe. Everybody, God bless America. Take care.
Welcome back. This is Let's Talk America. And I thought, in light of the discussion I knew I would have with Gordon Chang, it might be worthwhile for me to take this segment of the program. And instead of us having another guest, I'd hold forth about some of the implications about what I was just discussing with Gordon Chang. Because, as I said, I think it's the most serious prospect we face now as a people. And I don't think most Americans are even aware of the real danger that we are faced now with a determined adversary, and that adversary, by the way, may include a cooperative Russia, but I don't think Russia is our major problem. And I think that, and I've marveled for the last, couple of decades, I guess, as to why American administrations in general, what would you expect, I guess, from pro-communist, at least in basic temperature, that we've had the Democrat Party has offered us the Clinton years, and they've offered us the Obama years. And if anybody out there thinks that Clinton and Obama and now Biden, judging by his actions as we have discussed them and the whole background, are people that we should rely on for leadership in order to extinguish a growing existential threat to the survival of our way of life, I beg to differ with you. I don't know what you're smoking, I don't know what you drink, but whatever it is, it's seriously deranging your perspective. We now have at the helm an administration that has taken actions that utterly disregard the ordinary prudence that simply maintains the economy. He came in with the determination, and they are proceeding with budgetary fantasies and so forth, determination to say, we're just going to focus on the agenda with extinguishing climate change and so forth and so on. We're going to focus on the agenda that has us all abandoning the basic premises of God-endowed unalienable rights and thinking in terms instead of the utopia that can be produced by an elite control of our institutions, driving us toward that utopia in the name of the people, the people, the people. You have noticed, I hope, that all that emphasis on the people in the Democrat Party, right? Because you would take that right in their name, Demos, people. They're supposed to be the party of the people. And maybe at one point in the history of the party, you could see in their actions and things, things that actually showed a concern for working people and for people who had to earn a living rather than live off wealth and et cetera. But I don't see it now, because otherwise, if they were of a mind to actually help us out, do you think that they would be taking an approach that actually drives us deeper into the forest in which our money, such as we have it as ordinary folks, loses value every day on account of their spendthrift ways? And that those spendthrift ways being devoted to things that, just by the way, ignore the fact that we are faced now with an existential situation in the world where at least one major power unequivocally is committed to proving itself in historic sense by way of war. Are we awake here expecting that somebody who, and a party that has no particular interest even in maintaining our way of life? And why do I say that? Because they don't really believe in it anymore. A thoroughgoing Marxist-Leninist communist-type party, which they are have pretty much become, that party can't be committed to preserving the Constitution of the United States. They, in fact, have no stake in that combination of three things that has actually accounted for, I believe, the success of the United States. The first one being a founding that was based on an understanding of right and justice for all human beings that depended on the will of God. Now, I know, You can just look at me and know that I'm fully well aware that our history, whether you start with the revolution and move forward, whatever you do, it's not necessarily uncheckered with all kinds of problems, including problems that are endemic to human society, like slavery, by the way. We all forget that, don't we? We forget that there's been slavery in every era and practically every nation and on the face of the earth, and so forth and so on. And that the most remarkable thing I think that can be said about the government of, by, and for the American people is that even though it tore them apart, the end result brought us back together on a ground that acknowledged our vocation for humanity. Okay? This is, by the way, if you think it through, what explains what the Democrat Party is now doing and why I call it the anti-American Party. Because they want us to focus only on those things that are about the fact that we are a nation of nations, that we have in this country by now probably representatives in some form, way, shape, or form of every nation on the face of the earth, of every background, of every color, and every race, and every creed. We have, in living up to the promise of our founding, eventually also, we lived up to the scope of what the founders took on when they changed from discussing the rights of Englishmen to discussing the rights of human beings in general, as endowed to each and every one of us by the God who is in fact responsible for the order of all things in the universe. It's a bold premise, and they boldly committed us to it. And what I think is even more surprising, time after time after time, even at the expense of treasure and blood, the American people responded to the call to put our reverence for that goal above other things, and to go out and risk and give our lives, first for the country itself and its continued union, under the banner of God-endowed unalienable rights understood to include all human beings, not just this or that race. Why do the Democrats want to try to convince the oncoming generations and anybody else who will listen that this country is about critical race theory and everything that divides us? And that in no sense at all should we be thinking through the fundamental premise of our nationality, which is humanity itself, when you think it through. Okay? We're destined, I think, from the moment that the founders made that choice to extend the scope beyond what they could see on account of their situation as Englishmen, which, yes, would have meant at that time pretty much white people, but it also meant that they were going to be divided from other white people, which is was what gives the lie to a lot of this stuff that the critical race theory people are always trying to develop. From the point of view of the United States of America, it turns out that the only race that's critical to our survival is the sense that we share a common humanity that makes us part of that one human race that we are called to represent by the very premises of our founding. And that's why, over the course of time, the door was more and more thrown open to the fulfillment of that promise because it attracted people from everywhere. Now, suddenly, we are faced with a party that is dedicated to getting us to forget the common humanity and think only in terms of the division. And when you think that through, y'all, you should realize, why would somebody do that? Well, most of the time, nations have been sort of pleased and buoyed up by the fact that they stood on common ground, that there was something that made every heart beat high, and so forth and so on, but not the Democrat Party of today. The Democrat Party of today wants us to focus on the differences, wants us to feel ashamed of those things which tainted all humanity, right? And therefore tainted humanity in the United States, like slavery, but which were eventually overcome by the power of that common ground which loomed larger and larger and larger in the course of our history until at the end of the day in the 20th century, we went to war over and over and over again, not in the name of our own power, not in the name of some skin color or racial background, but in the name of justice and right according to God for all humanity. And I know When I get to talking about this, I always have to remember it's still not much anymore the focal point of our political leadership. And I got to tell you, I don't understand why. We actually are in a position as a nation to enjoy the fruits, the unequivocal fruits of what has been the sacrificial commitment of the American people to try to turn that aspiration about right and justice for all humanity into a reality. Now, did everybody agree on it at all times? No, they don't. As a matter of fact, I'll have to be frank with you. I don't think the Democrats agree with the premises of this country's founding at all. No, they don't agree with it at all. And why is that? Because you can't establish a government based on the premises that some little vanguard party is going to control everybody else, right? And still be committed to the understanding of government that our country was founded on, to the understanding of justice and right that the country was founded on, to the understanding in particular of God endowed unalienable rights, which the country was founded on. I think that's kind of confessed by the other part of it, because when the country was founded, there wasn't exactly a Republican Party at first. There were the Federalists, who were called Federalists because they were committed to the form of government established by the Constitution. And that form of government was a government in which you had a central administration for dealing with things, mostly at first, the common defense of the country. That would have been the motivation, but also in order to work together, in order to achieve goals that would contribute, as they did, to the prospects of prosperity for the nation, but also, when they thought it through, the prospect of peace among the different states that comprised the nation. I think the speculation was there, and it was in their minds, of that contrast between a nation composed of the 13 original colonies and a nation divided into sections that would then be played upon by other outside forces and inside forces in order to keep us at loggerheads with one another. Now, that could have been the fate of the United States. That it wasn't had something to do with that commitment to an understanding that went beyond human ambition in order to recognize that there was a place in that ambition where we had to meet our obligations to the God, the creator, who was and is the orderer of the universe. I think that was a great gift to the people of the United States. And it was also a great opportunity, of course, as things having to do with God are often great opportunities, if you're willing to think them through in terms of his will. And I guess what has always redeemed both the American founding and, by and large, the progress made by this country, because we had our fair share, maybe more than our fair share, I don't know, but of folks who weren't particularly interested in anything but filling their own pockets and satisfying their own ambitions and satisfying their own lusts. I go through that, and guess what I'm thinking? Well, if it was the case that we had folks like that, which we certainly did in the course of American history, there are people who would be tempted to say that maybe, especially because we have been treating Christians like pariahs and we've been abstaining from remembering that our country is grounded in a sense of humanity that is not endowed by human preferences and background and ethnic this is and that, but rather by the intention toward humankind of God himself. So that we are called to answer a vocation that is not just dictated by our whims and by our wills, but by instead the intention of Almighty God. And I would have to say that I think, that when you look at the history of the United States all the way from the beginning, there wasn't always a majority of people you could say, that's a practicing Christian and so forth, that's a practicing believer, that's somebody who's moved by religious fervor. But there was always, always a vital, living segment of the population wrestling with how we think through the requirements that are involved in the premise of God-endowed unalienable right. which, as I often say, and I don't mind reminding people of it every chance I get, the word right, as used in the Declaration of Independence, is not synonymous with freedom. Freedom is a combination of power and opportunity. So you have the power to do it, you have the opportunity to do it, and then the question is, do you have the will to do it? And if you have the will and the power is commensurate with that will and objective, then you have freedom. You're free to do it. That doesn't make it right to do it, though, does it? No. And the country was founded on a premise that said, we have to have regard, however, not just for the power of the people. We have to have regard for, in our relations with one another and with humanity in general, how does God want us to treat one another? And if you don't mind my saying so, slavery notwithstanding, if people in the United States hadn't taken that seriously, they wouldn't have gone out onto battlefields. The Revolution, the Civil War, in particular, the Civil War, because they're all trying to make America a racist country, America founded in racism, and so forth and so on. That's a lie. America was founded on an understanding of the will of God. The Democrat Party is now almost completely and uniformly committed to driving God out of the arena, to make it as if it were true to say there is a separated church and state, you can't bring God into our polity. If they hadn't brought God into our polity, we would never have come into existence. We would still be languishing under a forms of government that are all about who has the power. And if that power is concentrated because of a combination of both prowess and intelligence in the hands of fewer and fewer people, that's the kind of government that rules. And it's the kind of government that has ruled almost everywhere, every time in the whole of human history. And we are a pretty unique experiment, this experiment in bringing folks together as folks, as human beings, and then trying to forge on the basis of our common humanity a sense of how we are to treat each other, how we are to accomplish the satisfaction of a standard of justice that goes beyond our predilections, goes beyond our ambitions, goes beyond what is of enormous influence to us, and also has a sense of being necessary so that humanity can achieve its ultimate destiny. And that destiny not defined simply in terms of more and more material progress and more success at, you know, producing this and producing that, but at greater and greater satisfaction of the demands of justice according to God, not according to our women will, whether or not they are convenient for all our ambitions. And it's part of what has always led me to retain my sense of respect for the country and for the people who inhabit it. But right now, we're seriously in danger. David Gordon and I were talking about the danger that can be posed by an opponent, like the present Communist Party of China and its leader. And that opponent can be acting in ways that pose a serious existential threat to us. But at the moment, I think the most serious problem is that we're not rising to the occasion of understanding and dealing with that existential threat, because there is an even more serious existential threat. And it is harbored right here in our own precincts, in our own nation, in our own affairs, in our own character or lack thereof. And because we are no longer a people committed to right and justice according to a higher standard than human power, we are being beguiled by people who have no other standard than power, and who therefore can worship at the altar of these regimes in the course of the 20th century that represented a consolidation of power in the name of the people that was never dependent on the will of the people themselves. We ought to wake up every day as Americans thankful that that wasn't the premise of our existence, that even though it required thoughtfulness and eventually battles and struggles of all kinds, including the civil rights struggle, the fact that we were a nation supposed to be committed to right and justice for all, liberty and justice for all, in a way that then gave that liberty a special meaning, because it didn't mean the freedom to do what you have the power to do, which is what it definitely means under the Marxist, Leninist, Maoist creed. It's the freedom brought on by power and not necessarily governed by any sense of right and wrong, except what is right for you to achieve whatever objective you have the appetite to achieve. Right. That's not who we are. And it's not what our parties are supposed to be either, by the way. Democrat Party now pretty much corresponds to that age-old understanding. And so it is a party that governs when it that gets the chance, like a little clique. You did notice, didn't you, all the totalitarian atmosphere that was created during the COVID crisis on the excuse of a virus that was, probably manufactured by discovered by and put in place by and then used by the communist Chinese. Is that just a coincidence? Well, how can we really trust a president who has made so much money off the communist Chinese? Some people would see that as possibly buying and selling the loyalty of that president. But we're not supposed to look at that. I think we are. We're supposed to look at it because as the sovereign people of the United States, I don't mean individual sovereigns, but the sovereign people as a whole, we are supposed to be the ruler, the one who chooses the ministers all up and down the line, the people who are going to carry out the government all up and down the line, drawn from where? From amongst ourselves, not necessarily as the result of bowing down to some king, potentate, aristocratic clique of any kind. And yet everywhere that communism has been implemented, it has resulted in the dominance of a little clique of people over all the rest. And the Communist Party of China particularly is evidence of that. We are now faced with what is more and more concretely becoming an embodied threat. The threat that that way of understanding human government is going to destroy our way. And we'd better start looking around for people who understand that that's the threat. Because if you don't understand it, like the withdrawal from Afghanistan, you're not going to do it very well. Ponder that. We'll be right back.